This is the November 12th, 2015 climate change law class, and it may not sound like it, but this is Tracy Hester. Today, we are going to be looking at a finer grain detailed level. We have talked about the international response to climate change. We've spent a great deal of time now on how the United States federal response to climate change is occurring within the framework of President Obama's Climate Action Plan and coordinated responses to clean air, clean water, endangered species, NEPA. And we're going to do one quick review look back on clean water to make sure we've captured the key points. But the bulk of today's conversation is going to be how states can respond to climate change, and to a little bit lesser detail, how cities and localities can respond. But the question I want to serve to you, and you can start percolating the back of your head, is if we were to sit together in our class and try and design a Texas approach to climate change, state level solely, what would we have to navigate? What are the pitfalls to avoid? What are the things that we might want to do, and how far could we push them? It's not a hypothetical question. I actually, at one point, was in the process of creating something called the Gulf Coast Carbon Initiative, which included several corporations as members in the early stages of the climate discussion. Included, for example, Enron, included Texas Instruments, Waste Management, interestingly enough, Houston Lighting and Power, now Reliant, Austin Energy, serious players. And we were trying to figure out what could we propose from a Texas perspective, including, if we needed to, coordinating with our adjoining states. And I'll tell you, the things in today's chapter, black and white, squarely drove our discussion. So this is not fanciful academic play. So let that marinate in the back of your heads. And in the meantime, let's just do our quick look back, because I always feel honor-bound to make sure you feel like you're comfortable with what we talked about in our last session, which was the Clean Water Act. And just to sort of remind everybody, takeaways here, if I had to boil our fascinating and fun discussion down, at least it was for me, I hope it was for you too. Number one, Federal Clean Water Act is going to be difficult to apply as a source of authority to restrict greenhouse gas emissions through NPDES or other point source permits. Just, there's a straight translation problem there. The statute requires a discharge of pollutants into waters of the United States from a point source. Most greenhouse gases obviously are not going to be in a gaseous suspended fraction of liquid. They're going to be into the air. So the corollary effects we're talking about are secondary. They happen once they've entered into the atmosphere and then render or change the quality of the waters. So how does the Clean Water Act play a role? And it turns out that there's indirect ways the Clean Water Act can step in. And we talked about, in particular, TMDLs, total maximum daily loads. Total maximum daily loads, basically all they care about is, does the water meet its use designation? And if it doesn't, how much can that water accept in the form of pollution and still be usable in the way that it was designated? And some of those parameters are squarely in the climate change arena, temperature and pH in particular. So remember our two cases that were context of that discussion, the Pinto Creek and Bronzolino cases. Yeah, interesting issues. They all really kind of boil down to the two tools for your toolbox, the takeaways. One, you can list a body of water as impaired and requiring a total maximum daily load if it is polluted solely from non-point sources, which was an important first issue. The second, and this is the bite, if a water body is impaired and has a TMDL, a state, and by implication EPA, if they haven't given delegation, cannot issue new point source discharge permits that allow additional pollutants into that water body subject to that TMDL, unless the load allocation for that water body shows it can accept it, and there's a compliance plan in place that shows a glide path that that water body will eventually attain its use designation. And I'll pause here. Is that all sort of give you a warm feeling of comfort and familiarity. All right? So that's the core. That's the nut. The question as always is, now we have it in hand, how do you extrapolate it to climate change? Why does it matter to our class? And I guess the key things would be, if you have a TMDL that has parameters subject to climate change effects, you can end up with TMDLs that set waste load allocations and load allocations that must accommodate those effects. In other words, if I have a water body that's acidic due to CO2 exposure, and I want to put in a point source, and assuming that you meet the load allocation requirements and the compliance plan requirements of the Pronsolino case, if I want to get a point source discharge, I may have to over-control my acidity pH of my discharge more than I would have in the absence of those climate change effects to sort of offset them. Same thing as well if you're a state. Remember, it's point sources. You have the actual waste load allocation with a permit limit that controls what you discharge. Non-point sources don't get subject to NPDES, the point source permit system. Instead, states have a process where they're given money under the Water Act to encourage them to have management strategies, and they're more flexible and voluntary. The state has to address some of those climate change effects too through non-point source management strategies. So as you can see, it's kind of like, I like to think of it as sort of the climate water version of the eggshell plaintiff rule. If your water is already hurt, you may have to issue permits and have non-point source control strategies that acknowledge that reality and maybe require more from you than you would otherwise. That's sort of the micro footprint. The big footprint and the real issue, the one that kind of has the planetary implications for us all, is ocean acidification. The ignored, neglected half of climate change. We always talk about the atmospheric issues and surface temperatures, and everyone sort of says, we'll talk about ocean acidification later. But the truth is, we're seeing substantial acidification already. How does the Clean Water Act apply there? Well, it's fairly straightforward logical chain, isn't it? Waters of the United States include coastal waters. They also include, to some degree, exclusive economic zones. Even though they're regulated under a different statute, the Clean Water Act standard process gets incorporated by reference. So that means states with coastal waters have to give use designations for those coastal waters and determine if they are meeting those use designations, and if they're not, you actually have to have a TMDL for the part of the ocean that bumps up against your water, your coast. California, Texas, Florida, Carolinas, they have to sample the water off their coastline and see if it meets parameters necessary for their use designation. And that can be bacteria counts, it can also be temperature, it can also be acidity. So, imagine the global oceans are getting acidic and your coastal waters reflect that, and it's actually making your waters unusable for certain commercial activities like fishing. Your oysters are, for example, lacking the calcium they need to form shells. Does the Clean Water Act require a state to essentially push back on global ocean acidification? The Center for Biological Diversity filed a lawsuit saying absolutely. And actually, I couldn't resist. This is, I don't think, on the website, but if it is, here's a hard copy. That's the complaint the Center for Biological Diversity actually filed, saying the Clean Water Act requires Washington and Oregon to actually list impaired waters for global ocean acidification and come up with game plans to address them. And here's the decision in response to that complaint later, basically saying EPA was within its discretion to approve TMDLs from those two states that do not mandate offsetting actions for ocean acidification. All they do is study, collect data, and prepare for eventual plans on it. That's the bottom line lesson at this point. It's brewing. Right now we have an integrated guidelines that say how states, from EPA, saying how states should collect data on ocean acidification and how they can start integrating it into their planning. But there's no mandatory requirement that states have to offset ocean acidification or take steps to reduce it under the Clean Water Act. All clear so far? that leaves me with the last, and I think the most intriguing point. States, nonetheless, are doing it anyway. In particular, Washington State has begun a program to essentially engineer the pH of their coastal waters. It takes place through a combination of controlling what surface water discharges into the ocean and how acidic it can be, as well as, they're suggesting, actual chemical buffering of the water itself, all as a way to try to preserve their commercial oyster fisheries. So, interesting times in that respect.
So you said EPA said there's no mandatory requirement that states have to take steps to offset acidification in the TMDLs?
Yeah, that's correct. If I were to put it more precisely, the Clean Water Act does not compel states to prepare TMDLs that expressly mandate waste load allocations to address and offset ocean acidification. That means, bottom line, EPA could approve a TMDL that doesn't have control measures for ocean pH. Does that help? Okay. All right. So those are sort of my takeaways of that discussion, but the floor is open. If you had anything else you wanted to add to it or any questions about it before we turn the page to state actions. Ivan?
Do they always spend this long on just standing?
Yes. Oftentimes, I'd say, I don't know, I worry sometimes I have a skewed view of the universe, but almost more than any other field of law, environmental fights over standing. It's just the nature of the types of injuries you deal with, and also the difficulty courts have wrestling with dispersed large-scale injuries with latent injuries that manifest over time. But yeah, I think I can tell you it's very common to get a district court decision of which 80% is a standing discussion. And then you get to the grist of it, and the grist is sort of a discretion. Yeah.
Yeah, they used Friends of the Earth too, versus Laidlaw.
Yeah. And Lujan should pop up in there too.
Mm-hmm.
All right, any others? Okay. With that then, I'll turn the page. Literally. There we go. All right, we're done with international and national. We're now drilling deeper. What we're now going to talk about today is regional and state. And let me just sort of lay the stage a little bit with you, and then we can talk about the example I asked you to sort of percolate in the back of your head. Bottom line is that until recently, states were where the action was at. There has, as we've discussed, always been a gridlock at the congressional level for any type of federal statutory response to climate change in the United States. And Waxman-Markey's sad fate is the status quo still today. They also have been relatively little administrative activity until the Obama administration, and even now, it's winding its way through the courts with most, but still not complete success. You know, think about the tailoring rule. It was struck down, although the backed determination process preserves its applicability to at least 80% of sources. So what does that mean? It means that in the vacuum, come in if you'd like, in the vacuum, states have stepped up. Essentially, states actually have a role to play for multiple reasons. Do you know what that was? Did I actually confuse them by saying come on in?
Yeah? Maybe we're supposed to.
They couldn't detect the sarcasm?
I was just saying I felt like we were in a zoo because of two people like peeking in.
Our reputation is spread.
Yeah.
It's that class. Bottom line is states are some of the biggest greenhouse gas generators out there. We tend to forget that. If you look at New York or California or Texas, we're right up in the top with any other nation around. The number that always astonishes me is that we emit as much greenhouse gases as Germany. You know, awesome.
LA and Sweden, Texas and Germany.
Yeah.
Good analogies.
Yeah, it's just, so in a way, it does make sense that if we really wanted to take action and we were willing to forego concerns about potential tragedy of the commons concerns, which the book describes, that our actions would just be offset by others. States make sense. It's a logical way to approach. So essentially, as a framework, a metric to discuss this. The book has a lot of discussion about different approaches that have been tried. Let me just suggest to you, there are only two you really need to pay close attention to. The Regional Greenhouse Gas Initiative and California's AB 32 Greenhouse Global Warming Solutions Act. Those are the main two initiatives that have actually resulted in binding legal restrictions on greenhouse gas emissions. And they are very different beasts, but they highlight that different approaches can still arrive at the same point of effective greenhouse gas controls. The Regional Greenhouse Gas Initiative is worth special attention. I will tell you from the meeting we had with EPA's General Counsel. This EPA is looking to the Regional Greenhouse Gas Initiative, as the template for how they're going to design the SIP program under the Clean Power Plan for setting up trading in states that get fit. In addition, they are being very concerned and cautious about making sure whatever plan they come up with in the Clean Power Plan allows the Regional Greenhouse Gas Initiative states to maintain their system.
So that was a model SIP based off of the Regional Greenhouse Gas Initiative?
A model FIP.
Oh, FIP, okay.
Now, of course, the subtext there is if a state comes up with a SIP that contains similar elements, it will be presumptively approvable. So the REGI, as we affectionately call it, actually has some real-world relevance to national United States greenhouse gas policy. And I hope as you read it, it all sounded familiar to you by this point in the semester. I mean, essentially, picture the United States. I won't draw a bad map for you. Maine all the way down through Delaware. Every state is included in REGI with the exception of, thank you, Chris Christie, New Jersey, which was originally in but opted out. It essentially, as opposed to other approaches, it is a special purpose tool. It only restricts greenhouse gas emissions from power plants. It is not designed to cover an economy-wide cap. In addition as well, it is strictly a cap and trade system. There are no technology mandates, there are no permitting mandates. All it is allowances. So already you can see right there, this is a pure economist dream version of greenhouse gas regulation. It benefited in part from that most of the states in REGI already had state-only plans. So REGI is really sort of an overlay on top of them to allow more efficient trading between them and more cost-effective CO2 reductions. And as a result, it has a lot of the design elements we saw when we talked about Kyoto. So as a result, it does allow banking. It does allow credits for early reductions. It does allow a pool that's going to be withheld from the distribution so that you have essentially a reservoir of credits available for new projects. It has a slowly declining cap over a period of 2.5% a year. And most interestingly enough, the allocation is by auction, not by the Waxman Markey, avoiding all sorts of pejorative adjectives, political allocation of credits. So with that in mind, I just can't resist asking, the current price you may have seen was keyed in the readings to a safety valve. Essentially, if the price of allowances got to $10 a ton, a safety valve provision would kick in, which would allow expanded use of offsets, including international offsets, as well as the extension of the compliance period from a 3-year rolling average to a 4-year rolling average. It turned out, however, that the price of the allowances was dramatically lower than people expected. Bounced around $2 to $3, sometimes less than $2. Sorry, Nick, were you going to say something?
Oh, no.
You were just thinking? Okay.
Yeah, I was just thinking.
All right. But I'll just throw it out. There's sort of a glaringly obvious answer that no one anticipated to why that would happen. What would cause greenhouse gas credits and REGI to come in drastically under what the expected price was going to be once they actually rolled it out during the past decade?
It have to be because there's more emissions than they anticipated.
Right? No, that'd make the price go up.
Okay. I'm not an economist. You can tell.
No, but right. You've got the grist of it right there. So if the more emissions makes the price go up because you have to get a limited pool of allowances to authorize the emissions, what would make the price go down?
That there was unanticipated regulations that caused people to have to limit their
So lower emissions, right?
Yeah.
So either regulations, but basically people didn't need the allowances. So why bid for them?
Right.
So the market didn't collapse like Kyoto's market did, the European market, but it dropped substantially. But it wasn't a regulation. It was George Mitchell. The surfeit of natural gas available from hydraulic fracturing essentially made it easy for power electrical generators in the Northeast to switch from coal to natural gas, which lowered their CO2 emissions, which lowered their need to bid for the market to get allowances to emit. So picture, if you would, if there's a graph, and I'm sparing you more bad drawings here, you would see a gradual decline in the price and then a sort of steeper drop. And now that is about 3 years ago. So here's the floor. Here's $10. Where do you think the price is now? Apply your knowledge as being experts in the climate change law after being in this class for a semester. What would influence the market if you were thinking about speculating to buy allowances? Would they be going up or down?
Up.
Why?
Because of the power
plant. Mm-hmm. Anything others? I mean, we still have lots of natural gas washing around.
There's lots of natural gas.
Okay. Well, actually, you should be trading. And actually, the thing I should say as a side note, I actually got asked by a trader whether or not there was a law student who might be interested in working, that they actually trade CO2 and criteria air pollutant credits here in Houston. It's called Element Markets. Sorry for the aside. down, and then in about the past 2 to 3 years, shook. The last auction in August, about $6. So the price is going up, but going up fast. And of course, no one explains why, but the bottom line assumption is that the Clean Power Plan is creating an assumption that those allowances are going to be much more valuable in the future.
Are they banking?
Interesting question. Not to my knowledge. I think right now you would think they would be, and they might be, but they're not announcing that they're doing it. And, you know, frankly, there's no reason why it has to be utility banking it. Element Markets or other types of commodities traders could speculate and just hoard them if they wanted to.
How often are the auctions held?
I think once a quarter. I'm not sure about that, though.
And so it's kind of hard for me to understand how this all works. So you get all your credits at the auction,
mm-hmm.
and then there's kind of like a roll call where you have to present your what are they called?
The allowances.
The allowances. You have to present them. If you come up short, something has to happen. You basically have to account for all your emissions. And then you start over, and there's a new auction. You have to repurchase. That's exactly right. That's how it works.
The fudge factor that's designed to protect states from getting killed by spikes is it's a 3-year rolling average. So if you're short and have to buy some 1 year to make up the difference, you can average over a 3-year period your compliance at the number of credit allowances that you buy. So if you're short 1 year, you can roll over and buy the next year as long as the average over the 3-year period moving forward still shows you're meeting your emissions requirements.
And how does the banking, like, can some people withhold theirs when, like, I guess if you're not an emitter and you're just someone who's bought them and you're holding them, like some venture capitalist or something,
yeah,
you don't have to give them up. It's just that if you're an emitter, you have to present the number of credits and allowances to account for your emissions.
You're absolutely correct. You could hoard credits. You could try and corner the market on credits.
So an emitter could hoard credits also. They just have to have enough to...
Exactly. And again, give me 2 minutes to go off the reservation with you, but absolutely. One of the first projects I worked on was a proposal by someone who was buying credits of a different nature, PSD credits for particulate emissions, with the express design of buying more than they needed so that they'd soak up any credits that might be available to their competitor across the street. You can do that. The interesting question is, to what extent can you game a cap and trade market? How many of you remember Project Death Star in California with Enron?
Mm.
Yeah.
They were the ones causing the rolling blackouts, right? It was like
allegedly, yeah.
They
But express and cynical moving of electricity in and out of state borders to manipulate the energy market,
mm-hmm.
so that they would create artificial scarcity and drive up spot prices in the market by factors of 1,000. and it contributed, arguably, to Burrowing Brownouts. People argued about that. The bottom line is that if you listen to the recordings of the Enron traders, it's very clear exactly what they're doing. They're trying to essentially push the market to a corner and take advantage of it when the price spikes up. And the persons who ultimately pay for it were California consumers. There's a lot of concern cap and trade will have the same effect for greenhouse gas emissions. Yeah, if you fold in on top of that, that the market will develop outside of the rules, a private secondary market will develop where people will start selling derivatives and futures and other contractual instruments designed to spread risk. And those are typically traded in incredibly complex and opaque private deals. There's a lot of concern about that. The argument is a corollary to that. At the panel I was telling you about with the carbon tax discussion on Tuesday, I got into a rather heated discussion with someone about the fact that if you think about it as a tax lawyer, your highest calling is to design a tax-efficient strategy to minimize the taxes you pay, which is the exact wrong answer if you're an environmental lawyer, because then you're failing to capture the environmental cost if you're figuring out ways to essentially discount the taxes. So is there such a thing as a tax inversion for environmental taxes? Then what would the effects of that be? We're still arguing about that. Okay. All right, so that's sort of the big picture with RGGI. Any questions about RGGI at this point? Because what I'd like to do is contrast it to AB 32 in California, and then talk about how we might apply that to Texas. By the way, as a side note, you'll notice what I'm not talking about, the Western Climate Initiative. It tried to be a RGGI-like structure for the West Coast. And the book charitably says that it's not a mature market yet. The honest answer is it's dead. It really hasn't gotten off the ground. It really hasn't translated into any real substantive regulatory issue. That's a bit of my personal opinion, but I don't know of anybody who factors WCI into their planning right now. all right, that's regional. The other way to go at this is state only. And California here not only leads the way, it kind of is the only one leading the way at this point, in a sense of having an internal binding framework to restrict greenhouse gas emissions. Essentially, AB 32 sets up a mini version of what you'd see in a national plan. It requires California to reduce its greenhouse gas emissions to 1990 levels by 2020. As opposed to RGGI, it is only within California. As opposed to RGGI, it includes the entire economy, not just the electrical utilities. So refineries, paint manufacturers, mining operations, you know, everyone gets swept into the net. It also uses a cap and trade, even though the statute doesn't require it. It, however, does allocate allowances based to some degree on historical use, especially for utilities. Utilities essentially get them allocated for free to them as long as they pass on the savings to their users. It also applies to fuels. California is mandating the use of low carbon fuels as under the AB 32 framework, so which raises all sorts of interesting issues as well. Bottom line is that AB 32 only in the past 2 to 3 years has actually had some binding emission limitations put in place. So far, preliminarily, the results look to be good in terms of actually getting compliance and some progress. However, it has triggered a rat's nest of challenges. Number one, and these will be relevant as well to our state versus regional discussion in a minute, challenges on environmental justice grounds. And these are the sort of challenges you see with any cap and trade market system. I mean, we talked about it a little bit before. We discussed the Kyoto framework, Kyoto Protocol framework, and the European trading system. But the lawsuits in California challenging the AB 32 cap and trade auction system, essentially, were by environmental activists claiming that the system was going to hurt poor and impoverished communities. And just sort of refresher, everyone remember why that would happen? What the possible scenario was that would cause a market to punish lower income or ethnic communities? Spencer?
Market would force industry to move to lower income, more impoverished areas that have lower emissions, so they'd just go pollute these impoverished areas?
In a way, it's pretty close. Is it?
I guess kind of, I'm trying to like what?
But by that rationale, they want to move to, you know, Yosemite, where the air is clean and they have more to pollute.
Yeah, I guess that's true. Well, I was thinking about like how people were worried when NAFTA was set up, the whole industry was just going to move to Mexico because they had the most lax.
Mm-hmm. But I think you've got the right germ of an idea there. Albert, do you as well?
So the lesser affluent neighborhoods won't have the financial resources or the knowledge to know how to properly fight and contest actions taken in their neighborhoods, whereas any of these industries that are near affluent neighborhoods, they're more likely to see legal challenges.
Absolutely true, but that applies to any environmental permitting program, not just to cap and trade markets. What is it about a cap and trade market that makes it such a hot spot for environmentalists?
As I say, you could just, like, the company wants to stay in one of those areas and just dump a bunch of pollution and just buy up, just keep paying to just keep polluting
mm-hmm.
in some of these areas. Kind of the cap and trade presents kind of a unique way where they never have to improve their emissions and they can just continue to do it and just continue to buy and pay money.
Right, essentially. And Joe, is that what you're going to be your comment as well?
That, and exactly, and then predicate that on, I think, the discussion we had in environmental law where oftentimes you get some of the most polluting industries near lower socioeconomic communities. That's the kind of the predicate argument, I think, where you begin with a lot of environmental justice and then the argument that you're going to be polluting regardless. You know, you're just going to be buying the permits. So the pollution's like your Manchester picture, the example of Chavez High School.
Mm-hmm.
I was going to add one thing that I can't remember. So
hot spots? Did you whisper hot spots? I thought I heard you whisper.
I whisper lots of things.
although I said hot spots as an unsubtle clue. it warms my heart you actually remembered the presentation, though. Thank you very much. But that concern focuses typically on criteria pollutants. If I've got an increased emissions due to cap and trade of particulate matter, that hits the neighborhood. Greenhouse gases mix almost immediately. They don't have localized impact.
Are we talking about like Nunavut, or not Nunavut, but the like Alaskan mm-hmm. First Nation?
I'm just talking about a neighborhood in Los Angeles that's next door to the Atlantic Richfield Refinery. And if I spew greenhouse gas CO2 up into the air, it's not going to create a dome of CO2 over the neighborhood. It disperses globally. That's the thing about CO2 that makes it so difficult to regulate.
Doesn't some technology that cuts down CO2 cause a rise in non-greenhouse gas?
That would argue for, that means that they would be fighting people attempting to control greenhouse gas emissions.
I know, that's my question, but isn't that paradigm, doesn't that happen? Like some control technology causes other pollutants to go up?
Absolutely, and I think you've grasped the nettle there. The question here is fellow travelers. If you have greenhouse gas emissions, you can almost always infer other pollutants are also being emitted.
Well, and that was your ammonia example, correct? The other day when we were talking about the CCS, the book gave almost no credence to that argument. So you're saying that Nick's grabbing the metal of the nut of the argument, if you will. So is that where we're headed, to these passenger pollutants?
No. I want to keep two things separate, and I'm curious. I missed the part in the book where they gave no credence to the argument, because the first one that I was describing previously, that control measures may cause increases of other criteria pollutants that would trigger full-fledged PSD or NSR review as part of greenhouse gas controls under the Clean Power Plan, that is a big issue, and EPA is taking it deadly seriously. So if the book says something differently, this is one of those rare times I tell you the book's dead wrong. The other issue, though, is different. That's what I described was Nick's point, where if I decrease greenhouse gases, others go up. What I'm talking about is where they both go up. So if I emit more greenhouse gases, I'm burning more coal, I'm also emitting more mercury, emitting more particulates. So here's the catch. A market doesn't care. What it wants is the efficient allocation of allowances to where it is cheapest to emit. So a market would tend oftentimes to consolidate emissions in an area where there might be some geographic or other type of advantage to emitting in that locality. And as a result, environmental groups were very concerned that you could end up with a pocket of heavy industry that bought allowances so they could continue to emit or even relocate to that area because they could more conveniently take advantage of allowances. And then as a corollary, increase emissions of other pollutants. That's the hotspot concern. Now, the reason I mention that is, one, AB 32 actually addresses that. It's the only statute I'm aware of that talks about hotspot control of markets in the greenhouse gas context. It wasn't enough to stop the lawsuit, but at least they considered it. And number two, it wasn't just a challenge under the AB 32. And this is another important point just to mention. It also invoked a different statute for a new purpose. California has its own NEPA, called the California Environmental Quality Act, CEQA. CEQA requires even more detailed assessments of environmental impacts of state action. Their argument was that the state failed to conduct a full-fledged and adequate environmental impact assessment under CEQA, and therefore the entire program had to be basically torn down and redone. Bottom line here for you guys is I wanted to be aware of the concern and some of the legal issues involved. They lost. That doesn't mean the issue goes away, particularly with EPA's increased emphasis on environmental justice. So that's AB 32 in conjunction with REGI. Any questions on how those sort of two approaches compare with each other before we start talking about sort of more general thoughts and then applying them to Texas? Because that, unfortunately, I'm fairly provincial in my mindset. Okay, so I've given you those two as examples. Let me give you some general thoughts then as to what happens when you extrapolate them to other states, which is going to start happening now with the Clean Power Plan. Number one, as a matter of law, states are free to set their own limits. That's what AB 32 teaches us. And other states have. They can go beyond the federal minimum. So as a result, Washington, for example, expressly requires carbon capture and sequestration for new coal-fired power plants. And I can tell you from my days as long ago as 1993 at Baker Botts, that killed a project or two. You just cannot make the demonstration that that technology was feasible and accomplishable. Florida, New Hampshire, other states also have expressed emission reduction programs in place that aren't quite sophisticated or as broad as AP 32, but they're trying. Number two, even if a state doesn't have its own global climate plan or statute, it is certainly free to adapt and extend its existing laws for other purposes. We've talked about this theme all through this semester. I mentioned CEQA, another one where you're seeing states backdoor in greenhouse gas as a matter of state law is under their BACT determinations, B-A-C-T. Remember, states set BACT, and they can choose to do top-down, they can go bottom-up, they can choose whatever method EPA will approve, but by and large, if they require inclusion of greenhouse gases, that's within their state prerogative to do so, even if arguably EPA would not mandate it. And last, it doesn't even have to be a greenhouse gas program. Some of the most effective, powerful, and frankly, self-perpetuating programs are programs that essentially require uses of particular kinds of renewable energy, which effectively are greenhouse gas programs. In particular, I'm discussing Renewable Portfolio Standards, RPS. A state can essentially dictate that electricity providers in that state must use either a certain number of megawatts from renewable energy or a certain percentage of their power from renewable energy. And while it may be couched to multiple grounds, bottom line is that effectively those are some of the most effective greenhouse gas statutes in the country, bar none. Texas, ironically, is way in front of other states in this regard. We have an RPS portfolio requirement that is probably one of the most aggressive in the country. And we were actually, if I remember correctly, going to be getting 10,000 megawatts by the year 2025. We bumped that up three times to get to that level, and we hit that mark 15 years early, and we're still at it. It's not just because of tax incentives. It's because Texas, with the possible exception of North Dakota, has the most wind resources in West Texas, as well as offshore. We have some of the prime wind resources just off of Corpus Christi and arguably off of Galveston. So huge boost for wind, huge boost for solar. Texas is also, I think, ranked number one for solar power potential in the United States. Don't lose sight of RPSs. I included a map on the website that, it, no reading on this, so I just want you to be aware of the concept, that showed the varying degrees of RPSs across the nation. And the vast majority of states has some form of RPS or renewable power mandate. So it's out there. It's the sort of reality of the land. RPSs typically have elements of a cap and trade system that you might want to be familiar with. In particular, you can separate the renewable energy component of your power that you're generating with wind or solar and then sell those renewable credits separately. You don't actually have to use the megawatt from a wind farm. So as a result, just like an allowance, you have a fluid and liquid market where people just buy what are called renewable emission credits, RECs, and you can basically cover your requirements through market purchases. As a side note, there is also a booming market in REC fraud. And we could talk about that some other time. Bottom line is, if you buy a bad REC, the person who holds the bag is you. You have to find another way to make up the difference and pay the penalties. You can bank RECs, you can borrow RECs, you can do early credits with RECs. They're in many ways just like a cap and trade. Any questions about those so far? Okay. One final note in terms of RECs and renewable portfolio standards in Texas. I just mentioned it, but how many of you have had a chance to work with the CREZ, C-R-E-Z, acronym worth knowing? It's the essentially the renewable energy corridor mandated by state law, where they have set up high power lines from all the way from West Texas to Central and East Texas to relieve congestion on the ERCOT grid and get renewable power. We're generating so much renewable power in West Texas to get it to where it's needed in urban areas. But CREZ is still being put into place. And in the meantime, we're getting to a point where they literally are giving the power away for free in West Texas at night. The demand is so low and they're generating so much when the wind's blowing that effectively they're wasting it. California started to see similar issues as well. All right, those were concepts. Let me then list a few limits and then we can talk about Texas. Then the limits are fairly important but straightforward and hopefully will raise echoes in your heads from your con law classes. Namely, if a bunch of states want to get together and make an agreement, that raises a whole host of typical con law issues that you should be familiar with. Number one, Commerce Clause. To what extent does either the Commerce Clause restrict the ability of states expressly to engage this kind of conduct? Number two, does the Dormant Commerce Clause kick in even if you do not have an outright conflict with federal statutory law? Fold in Supremacy Clause with that first Commerce Clause issue. Second is Dormant Commerce Clause. Third is a unique and interesting one called the Compact Clause. Compact Clause essentially requires any agreement between states to essentially be approved by Congress. And there's some case law as to what constitutes a compact. And then last, foreign affairs preemption. Foreign affairs preemption being basically the Constitution gives express authority to the federal government to conduct the foreign affairs of the United States. I'll just simply note that California is already entered into an arrangement with Quebec so that they can trade emissions between the two areas. REGI explored similar types of trading arrangements, not only in Canada, but other nations as well. So there's some questions to what extent states had that capacity, period, to do it. So with those in mind, let's go back to our thought experiment. Imagine, if you will, oh, by the way, let's see. I'm not going to do it again. I forgot to hand this out the last of class. I'm sorry, this is disrupting the flow of thought, but damn it, I'm going to do it anyway. Ocean acidification. this is a decision that came out just last month from EPA. There is an attempt to have the Toxic Substances Control Act declare carbon dioxide as a toxic substance because of ocean acidification it causes. EPA has denied the petition. I just thought you guys would be interested in it. I think I put it on the website as well. So sorry I didn't get that out to you earlier. All right, now back to our discussion of the example. Imagine, and this is as best as I can recreate it for you, you are sitting in a conference room just like this one. You are surrounded by predominantly corporate representatives and a few outside lawyers. The corporate representatives are the groups that I've mentioned previously. Large energy traders like Enron, large power generators like basically Reliant, large greenhouse gas emitters such as Waste Management from their landfill operations, sizable utilities such as Austin Energy, which provides power directly to end users, all of whom are looking around and seeing California taking early action, seeing RGGI setting into place its parameters for trading, and seeing EPA thinking about and using these examples to incorporate what its federal standards are going to be. And the question is, should we create a Gulf Coast Carbon Initiative? And if so, what should it encompass, and how far can we go with it? What would the law prevent us from doing? So I'll pause here and simply say there was, and please, I think none of this is confidential, but treat this as a hypothetical. I'd greatly appreciate it. But the discussion I'm describing to you, people came to the table with no preset ideas. It was really in a spirit of creativity, is this worth pursuing? So with that in mind, times have moved. We now have the Clean Power Plan. We now have the tailoring rule and the subsequent backed fallout from that. There's obviously EPA initiatives going on underway. But to a certain extent, the argument is still worth discussing, assuming, perhaps counterfactually, that Texas might be interested in doing something, particularly if industry is pushing it. What could Texas do beyond the current RPS portfolio it has? To lay the ground a little bit further, keep in mind, Texas has already prohibited by statute any climate change nuisance lawsuits, so they're clearly concerned about it. Texas also, by statute, ordered TCEQ to permit greenhouse gas sources because the impasse between EPA and Region 6 and TCEQ over PSD permits for greenhouse gases was crippling the development of new sources in Texas. So business pushed the legislature to pass a law that compelled, over the governor's objections, greenhouse gas permitting in Texas. So it can happen. The problem is we need to have a sort of sense as to what we want. So with that in mind, the board is open. Based on what we talked about here today with RGGI and AB 32, what would you suggest for Texas? And based on what else you know from our class?
Do we have any other states online that we could sign an MOU with as far as just fleshing out what state actors we have?
Mm-hmm.
In this theoretical discussion, do we have other state actors with us at the table, or is it just Texas?
Well, two responses. One, I noticed you used the term MOU, Memorandum of Understanding, which was very adept of your part because, remember the Compact Clause, an MOU, essentially Memorandum of Understanding, it doesn't compel us to do anything. We avoid the designation of it being a compact. It may have some enforceability issues, but at least we have to go to Congress to get approved. The second is, why would you want to include the other states? That might answer your question. What are the reasons that would be benefit to Texas to include them?
Well, one is these issues are not regional, usually. I mean, we have regional pollutants, NOx and SOx, et cetera, VOCs. But I'd say the barrier, bless you, as far as it's a Gulf Coast initiative, we should try to get the Gulf Coast. I mean, we know that, I think, 100% of Texas's Gulf waters are impaired,
mm-hmm.
So that's probably not all Texans doing that.
So we have a broader array of potential corrective actions we can take if we're doing concert with other states.
If in concert, yes. There's much more we can do.
All right, that's one possibility. Any, Ronnie?
I was just going to ask, if you do include more states, will the valuation of the credits be higher or lower?
Well, you're assuming we're going to have with Texas a cap and trade system?
If you did have a cap, I mean, that's what we've been discussing before. Mm-hmm. I'm saying theoretically, if Texas did would you expect, those credits to be higher or lower?
Well, let's think it through. It may depend which states we're talking about. If we're talking about Texas and Louisiana, which also has a significant refining base, chemical production base, and big CO2 emissions, adding them to our pool creates a broader network of trading partners and the chance to find low-cost emitters that we can actually swap allowances with. New Mexico? Kind of a harder case there, isn't it? I mean, to what extent is there a substantial industrial base that would be worthwhile for us to include, and would there be potential objectors or competitors for allowances who may not have the same industrial interest Texas has? Yeah. And I'm not prejudging, I'm just simply pointing out, we may be interested in Louisiana, we may be interested in even Arkansas. Oklahoma depends on how broad we define our sources, but oil and gas exploration, a lot of methane there, maybe there's some possibilities. New Mexico, we might have to argue about that. Right now, none of those parties are at the table, so we have to decide to invite them. But it sounds like at this point, you guys are thinking, and I'm assuming you're not waving your hands and saying terrible idea, that you're interested not just Texas, but perhaps a broader collective action of states through an MOU, not a compact. Okay? All right, let's say as a working premise then, we're going to include the other states. Why cap and trade? I just offer it. I mean, you're right. Reggie's cap and trade. AB 32 is market trade. Why not a carbon tax? And is there any real value then to teaming up with other states if we have a carbon tax?
The carbon tax seems more difficult with the other states. If we're isolationists, I'm saying that cheaply, and it's just Texas, I think a carbon tax could be effective. But I think the cap and trade, if it is a true MOU in the sense that we have multiple states working together, I'd say the cap and trade is probably more likely to be accepted, one, in the political climate, and two, there's a better chance of at least, we've talked about this in other examples, getting your foot in the door as far as getting people to start agreeing that perception argument.
I don't want to cut you off. Wouldn't you run into a lot of issues with the carbon tax, with like the dormant commerce clause if you were...
In what way?
If the way it was set up, if you were taxing fuel or things that were coming in from other states in a way that unfairly burdened them, I think there would be a lot of constitutional issues more with a carbon tax.
And I'm literally thinking out loud with you on this. I'm not setting you up for an answer one way or the other, because I don't know. But it sounds like basket one, we set up a carbon tax that covers everything. We produce the fuel in Texas, we burn it in Texas, carbon tax applies. If we ship it out of state, we apply a carbon tax. If it comes into our state, we apply a carbon tax, one way or the other. The other is, we just limit it at one point when it comes out of the ground, or what other industrial activity we designate, like when the methane's emitted. If we're taxing what's coming into the state, that's not necessarily fatal. It depends on whether or not we're taxing in a way that's preferential.
If we're right.
You know, the case mentioned in your textbook, the Rocky Mountain Farmers Union case, I hope, was that part of our reading today? Or is that, I've read the whole book, so I lose track sometimes which one is which. Let me save you some reading. This case is very long and very recent. Bottom line is, California AB 32 system imposed essentially a weighted formula that imposed a fee on fuels based on their carbon emissions, based on a life cycle analysis. When you ran this analysis, lo and behold, it turned out that there's a bigger carbon footprint for renewable fuels generated in Iowa through corn ethanol as opposed to locally produced biofuels in California. Significantly so. So the Rocky Mountain Farmers Union sued, saying this is a violation of the Dormant Commerce Clause. District Court said, you're right, this is unconstitutional. The Ninth Circuit said no. They overturned and said essentially what we were just discussing, Dormant Commerce Clause is only invoked if you either expressly and explicitly facially discriminate, in which case it's strict scrutiny, this is the Pike Church test, or if it's just incidentally imposing substantial burdens on interstate commerce, you have to weigh in a balancing test whether or not the benefits of the local regulation outweigh the burdens of the interstate effects. So that kind of serves you up a steaming mess in our first basket. Mm-hmm. I don't really know. You know, if we're taxing fuels coming in, it depends on how we tax them, it sounds like. The second one seems to be cleaner, though. If we just tax what's coming out of Texas soils and ground, even if it's crossing a border somewhere else, that's just baked into the price to everybody. And I throw this out, and I literally just thought of it, and if you want to do a LaRavue note on it, you're welcome to it. In a way, it sounds like a severance tax, doesn't it? Are y'all taking oil and gas? Is anyone in the class doing oil and gas?
I'm taking oil and gas.
Right?
Yeah. Yeah.
Do y'all talk about severance taxes in the class?
We haven't yet.
Okay. Essentially, a severance... well, Caroline knows what a severance tax is. You're going, yeah.
I thought that was just a tax that's applied when you take the
oil. Yeah. And essentially,
oh, that's right.
And when you ship it out of state, the tax applies. And that's been upheld on constitutional grounds. So you captured it. That's all you need to know. I mean, to a certain extent, imagine we called it a sort of carbon version of a severance tax, which Texans love, because essentially we're shifting the cost to other members who consume our fuels. That's been a huge generator for the Texas Treasury for years. Basket 2 might be more politically feasible if it's couched in that light.
What is the benefit for us imposing a tax on ourselves if other states aren't doing that? That seems like the industry would not be, like, you know, Shell and other industries would like that at the federal level because that's even, but it seems like we're just intentionally disadvantaging ourselves, whereas the cap and trade.
You are absolutely dead right, and that's the biggest objection at this point. I'll simply point out one way to deal with that, if we were to analogize to our World Trade Organization discussion, would be an equalization payment. But I'm really, really reluctant to think that would pass dormant commerce clause restriction to say that people who are bringing things into the state from other places that don't have a carbon tax have to pay an equalization amount so that it's fair to Texas. That's facially discriminatory. I'm sorry, Spencer, were you going to say something?
Well, did you say that a tax that specifically and only targets oil and gas production you think would be more politically feasible?
I'm saying if it was analogized and sold as a severance tax or a fee,
okay,
and you avoid the dreaded carbon tax label.
Yeah.
By the way, I'm wholly and completely admitting this is a completely counterfactual assumption. The odds that Texas is going to pass its Global Warming Solutions Act anytime soon are, is it possible to have a negative probability? I don't know. But it's a nice template for us to think about what sort of legal considerations kick in. But if the bulk of our CO2 emissions come from production of fossil fuels, the general rule is, for an economist's perspective, the more efficient tax system is the one that's furthest upstream. So if you get it out of the ground and tax it there, that tax cascades all the way through down. If you try and tax how people burn it, suddenly it's a much broader and complex universe. Or even if it's distributed and used to actual consumer use, like a VAT tax, it's just unimaginably complex. All right, so we've kind of just sketched out rudiments at this point. Carbon tax or cap and trade, if Texas were to go forward. Any other constraints or things to worry about in terms of setting up? Like, what would example be if, are we going to include any kind of issues in terms of giving credits to emission reductions in Mexico? I mean, this is some of our discussion about the Clean Power Plan come back again through a Texas Global Warming Solutions Act. I raise that because one of the constraints on a state solution is to the extent that it impacts foreign affairs. Essentially, the bottom line comes down to this. Even if Congress has enacted, if the president has taken action under executive order, it can preempt inconsistent, even if it's not directly conflicting, but inconsistent state action. If our Texas Global Solutions Act, Global Warming Solutions Act, in some way conflicted with an executive order that President Obama issues after Paris, essentially under the Garamendi case that's listed in your book, that executive authority is enough under the president's foreign affairs power to, it's actually preempt, not displace, preempt our state statute. So we have to be very careful about to what extent we incorporate credits or trades across the border. There's very bright lines as to how far we can go with the state power in that regard. Anything else that we'd throw out here?
The basket of pollutants and greenhouse gases we're going to include. The general six that you see in some of the other, like, is it Reggie that has the six, or is it maybe 32? I can't remember.
Well, Reggie only has CO2. But remember, it's just power plants.
And that's AB32.
AB32 has everything. It has sulfur hexafluoride, for example. You're absolutely right. Do we include more than just CO2? It's easier with just one. With a basket, we have more flexibility. Do we want to limit what counts as offset measures? You know, say you have to do certain things, or we just simply say, measure it, and we'll give you credit. Do we want to require independent authorization? Essentially have a whole industry of third-party auditors who are going to go out and verify what these credits are that we're going to trade or the taxes that we're going to pay. Are we going to have someone designated to control the process? And if so, who? Interesting question. I mean, do we want the Texas Comptroller controlling a carbon tax, or do you want the Texas TCEQ? Or both? The bottom line is that that's what happened to our discussion when we first raised this issue. It got very complex very quickly. The other thing that happened, just sort of a point, is that fissures opened up very quickly as well among the participants. The people who sell power, the people who make power, the people who do chemicals, as you start talking about the design of the system, they all start going in different directions. So ultimately, the Gulf Coast Carbon Initiative turned into an effort to essentially create an entity that would design ways to measure and reduce greenhouse gases, but not require those reductions, so that we'd have some reason to sit at the table with the other folks around the country and talk about what we know. And even that quickly kind of lost steam after a while. It was a hard sell in Texas. So with that, despite my promise to finish early, and my voice is held up, any questions or thoughts about what states can do, what the legal limits are, what Texas, California, and Reggie have had on the table? Okay. All right. Well, then I hate to tell you this. We've got maybe one more class. Don't forget, next Tuesday, we're touring the power plant. And we will be talking with their environmental crew about what their greenhouse gas permitting obligations are. Also, on Thursday, I've called David Gerger, who is the partner managing O'Quinn Emanuel, which is one of the top white-collar defense firms here in town. David Gerger also represented Andy Vastow in the Enron meltdown litigation to see if he'd be interested in having it. If he says yes, our class on Thursday will be at noon. It will be an open class. We'll have lunch provided to everybody. And it'll be a moderated dialogue where I and David will talk about how RICO, securities disclosure, and other civil conspiracy liabilities might apply to Exxon in light of its inconsistent climate statements, and to other energy companies. If he says no, we'll just meet our regular time here. What I would ask is if you could, to make sure we get our hour and a half that's required by state law, if we could meet a little bit early, like 30 minutes before, so you can actually talk with David one-on-one and we can talk a little bit about the background, just meet here and then go to our classroom where it would actually be, I'd appreciate it. And then after that, after next week, it's just a voluntary review session on Tuesday. So. And that's, if you all got together and decide you didn't need it, I'm also happy to just bring pizza and we can just hang out and talk. So whatever you feel like. So with that in mind, any questions about what's ahead or what we've talked about today?
Could we do a review session with pizza?
That's a good question.
I like that idea.
Happen now.
How about this? I won't make any promises, but you know, if a surprise were to happen, I'm not sure pizza at 10:30 in the morning is the best thing.
Perfect. Do you have any more Foster cookies?
Pizza and cookies.
We could do.
How about everybody?
Actually, the part of the reason I'm a little bit scattered this morning, let's turn this off.